It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
We've heard from the president via Twitter on Omarosa.
Are you expressed how you feel about Omarosa?
The president said he kept Omarosa on despite complaints from her colleagues.
You said one of the motives for Omarosa was to tear this entire place down.
Are you saying you would like the president to stop tweeting about Omarosa?
Omarosa.
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 That's how the week started. You know, the press was just obsessed with Omarosa. And it occurred to me as I was thinking back on this week that I never said anything about that. And I know that my opponents will say, you never talked about her. I didn't. And I don't want to talk about her very much because I think it's a tabloid story. And I often avoid those. Omarosa is a person of very little character. There's just no question about it. She has illustrated that to the world by her multiple interviews with various media outlets. And so she has no character, and I think it was just a terrible betrayal to President Trump, who had really made her career. But I think President Trump was way out of line to get engaged on Twitter with her, to call her a dog. That was too much. I wish he had never done that. But I would say that calling her a dog was consistent with his language. He has called, I could rattle off half a dozen at least people that he's said were fired like a dog. He's a dog. He's a dog. Most of them were men. So it's not a racial or sexist tweet, but it's very poor taste, and the president should not do that. Omarosa discredited herself in front of all of us without his help. And one interesting little tidbit on that before I move on. I didn't realize, did you, that Omarosa worked in the Clinton White House? She worked in the Clinton administration. She worked directly for Al Gore, and she was fired four times. She was fired four times. This is what some of the staff said. She was asked to leave as quickly as possible. She was so disruptive. She was also bounced from a previous position at Commerce because she couldn't get along with people. And then another person said she didn't do her job and it got everybody into trouble. And there's a lot more about that. That was in People magazine, by the way, reported back in 2004. So I guess the president didn't really know who Omarosa was when he hired her. But that was a dreadful situation, and thank goodness. I think the press is actually glad they're not having to talk about her either. Also this week is the week that I explained to you why I sound so funny. And so I'm not going to go through that again, but just in case you weren't listening this week, I'm finally having teeth put in to replace the ones that were broken out when I had a terrible biking accident. So forgive my strange pattern of speech. It's just the way it's going to be for a bit till I get this thing finally taken care of. Another story that we didn't talk about, just horrendous story. Trace Gallagher laid it out a few days ago. Let's listen.
The two-year investigation covers every diocese in Pennsylvania except Philadelphia and Altoona Johnstown. The report opens with a statement quoting, "We, the members of the grand jury, need you to hear this. There have been other reports about child sexual abuse within the Catholic Church, but never on this scale." It goes on to say more than 1,000 child victims were identified, but the real number might be in the thousands, mostly boys, some girls, quoting, "All of them raped in some way, all of them brushed aside." For example, one priest admitted assaulting at least a dozen young boys, and the bishop then wrote a letter thanking him for helping God's people. Another priest confessed to sodomizing and orally raping 15 boys. The bishop commended him as a, quote, person of candor and sincerity. And a priest in Harrisburg abused 5 sisters in one family, even collecting samples of their body fluids. Despite incontrovertible evidence, the church sided with the priest. Years later, when he confessed, it was too late to prosecute. One of those sisters is now 37. Watch.
I just feel like my whole life has been a lie. I didn't feel comfortable at all. I still don't feel comfortable now in relationships.
And the church kept meticulous records of the abuse and the cover-up. The Pennsylvania Attorney General says documents from the diocese secret archives formed the backbone of the investigation. Listen.
The impact, especially when kept secret, lasts a lifetime. The time of telling these victims to keep their truth to themselves has ended.
The report is also very harsh on Cardinal Donald Wuerl, the former Archbishop of Pittsburgh and now of D.C., for his part in concealing the sexual abuse. Wuerl issued a statement calling it a tragedy, adding that he, quote, acted with diligence, with concern for the victims, and to prevent future acts of abuse. Because of death and statute of limitations, only two priests are facing charges.
All right, Tracy Gallagher, and could I just make two important points? We wonder why there's an outbreak of sexual confusion, of homosexuality among young males, of other kinds of perversion, of sexual perversion among women. This is the kind of thing that spreads, especially with men. You know, when men have been raped as children, they often act out then on friends, and they transfer that. It doesn't stop with them. Sometimes they become very sensitively wounded, like that woman who was featured in that piece, and other times they become abusers themselves. Is there any wonder there's an epidemic of this? This story is so dreadful. They said that in one case I'm not going to read this. It's just too hard. I would just say they created their own child porn. They made a little boy stand at a bed and take the position of Jesus on the cross. That's part of the story. They also marked these boys with little crosses, special little crosses, so that other priests could see who was groomed for abuse. This is abuse. If ever you wonder what sexual abuse really is, this is what it is. It's not why so many of these women in the Me Too movement are crying out about. Not all of them. Many of them are legitimate complaints. They are true sexual abuse, but it's not when somebody hugs you too long. It isn't that. Or he looked at me in a certain way. It isn't that. And when people use that, it makes these kinds of situations, it lessens them. We cannot just call everything sexual abuse, but when it is abuse, like that woman's story in this piece, it is dreadful. And this must be stopped, whether it's in a Protestant church where the pastor betrays his congregation, like Bill Hybels at Willow Creek in South Barrington, west of Chicago, or it's a Catholic church like this. This has to stop. And thank God for Josh Shapiro, the attorney general there in Pennsylvania, issuing this report. Still, there are people of God doing really wonderful things, redemptive things. And this is what we have to do to be salt and light in our world. You know, we're always wondering what we can do to help our troops. We talk about that all the time. Support the troops. Many of us have yellow ribbons in our windows. We do appreciate the service that men and women have done for our country, whether they've served overseas or served at home, whether they've helped during natural disasters. We are very grateful. Most of us are very grateful. And I think maybe because some are not grateful, we even feel more motivated to show our love and gratitude. Well, there's a very unique way to do that coming up Saturday, September 22nd. It's called Operation Tank Full of Love. It reminds me of an Elvis song. Operation Tank Full of Love. And the founder is Eric Horner, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Eric.
Well, good morning.
Don't you think that sounds like an Elvis tune?
It may. Operation Tank Full of Love, yeah.
Yeah, really, why not? Well, all right, so September the 22nd, and this is going to take place in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, which, by the way, Eric, is a beautiful place. I remember driving through there a million times when I was a kid. And tell people what this is all about.
Well, this is quite simply just a way for us to show our appreciation and for the body of Christ to be the hands and feet of Jesus to those who take care of our freedom. This will be our eighth year to do this, and I never dreamed what it would turn into when we did this the first year. I think we raised $8,800, and we really thought we'd done something, and it took us all of 2 hours to give that away. And so this is year number eight, and we are set to cross the $300,000 mark this year.
Oh,
we're just,
wow.
Just flabbergasted by that. You know, I can't do that, but God can. So we're very excited to be able to serve those men and women there.
Now, when you do this, do you have one particular gas station, or do you hand out, like, vouchers or money? How do you do that?
Well, You know, I've had people contact me from around the country wanting to know, hey, how can we do this in our area for our military post? It's you've got to have a lot of pieces of the puzzle in place, and Fort Campbell just happens to have that. We have a truck stop, a really big truck stop right down the road from Fort Campbell. Have a big park. You got to have a big parking lot, and you have to have a police department willing to cooperate with you and help you with traffic. The first 2 years we did this, we shut the entire town down. You couldn't go anywhere near Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And so the police got involved, and they helped me. And there's just, for us, it gives us the volunteers the chance to serve the soldiers. We want to be there and look them in the eye, pray for them if they have a need. And it's really a more personal way than handing out vouchers. This way we'll have probably 100 to 120 volunteers from churches all around the area. And there was simply, you know, the goal of being the hands and feet of Jesus to those who take care of our freedom. And we're able to look them in the eye and thank them personally. And if they have a prayer need, we're able to pray for them. So it's just kind of a more of a hands-on way instead of, you know, if we had to do it in a manner where we just, you know, met somewhere and handed out vouchers, we would. But this is much better. This is a more personal way, I think.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. Makes me want to get on a plane and come to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Now, what you need from people listening is their financial support, right?
Yes. We will serve 1,800 soldiers during a day's time, and depending on gas prices, that's a lot of money. But it's really neat to watch the Lord just provide it through His people year after year. I used to worry and fret over it. You know, I'd say, oh, we're 3 weeks out, and we're only sitting at this amount. And every year the Lord just, you know, speaks and moves through His people, and we always have enough to serve about 1,800 soldiers. And that's about all we can do from when we start in the morning at about 7 a.m. until we have to stop it at dark because it becomes a traffic hazard, and the police have asked us to do that. So it's just the Lord supplies the need.
Yeah. All right, so there you go, ladies and gentlemen. This is your part. You can donate by going to AFR.net. That's AFR.net. Or you can donate by calling 877-968-3742. That's 877-968-3742. It's Operation Tank Full of Love. Eric, one last thing. Any particular story? You've been doing it 8 years. And you talked about the personal touch, which I love. I just love this, where you really minister. You don't just give them gas. You actually, if they're receptive and need help, you're there to be a listening ear. Any story that stands out? Any interaction stands out?
There's a long list of them. You know, the government has a rule on the amount that you're allowed to give government service. For anybody that serves, the limit is $20. That's all they will allow us to give them. And when we first started doing this, we didn't know about that rule, and we were doing, you know, $50 or a fill-up per soldier. And, you know, when they brought that to my attention and made us to start, you know, following that rule, I thought, you know, they're not going to come, you know, for $20 worth of free gas. But I can't tell you the stories that we've heard. Hey, this amount of gas is going to help me to go pick up my son. It's my, you know, to have some visitation with my son. This makes a difference on what goes on the table for my family this week. And you'll see, they'll come through. The soldiers will come through with their families. Some of them will have 2, 3, 4 kids. And you can really see where the need is most. And it's just awesome to see, you know, what little we can give them. God can multiply that and make something really big out of it. And we've just had story after story all day long. We received messages and texts and Facebook posts from the soldiers just letting us know what a difference it made in their life. And so, you know, that was a good lesson for me that you know, because I thought, well, how much could this really be helping the soldier? Well, the Lord has shown me time and time again how much it helps the soldier.
That's the way He works, isn't it? And so it's called Operation Tank Full of Love, and it's going to be September the 22nd. And if you want to help, and I bet you all of you do after hearing Eric, visit AFR.net, AFR.net, or you can donate by calling 877-968-3742. That's 877-968-3742. Eric Hohner, God bless you. We'll be anxious to hear the news stories for this year.
Thank you so much, Sandy.
Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
The There's simply no evidence of bias in my professional actions.
FBI agent Peter Strzok, who was kicked off special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia probe for anti-Trump texts, was officially fired by the FBI Friday afternoon. Along with his former colleague and lover, FBI lawyer Lisa Page, the two exchanged thousands of texts where they criticized candidate Trump and his supporters. In a lengthy statement, Strzok's lawyer said the FBI's deputy director overruled the Bureau's disciplinary review that recommended a 60-day suspension and demotion, implying it was political. Quote, this decision should be deeply troubling to all Americans. A lengthy investigation and multiple rounds of congressional testimony failed to produce a shred of evidence that Special Agent Strzok's personal views ever affected his work. Strzok testified under oath last month.
Not once in my 26 years of defending our nation did my personal opinions impact any official action I took. This is true for the Clinton email investigation and for every other investigation I've worked on. It is not who I am, and it is not something I would ever do.
Strzok's attorney singled out FBI Director Christopher Wray, alleging Strzok's termination was a departure from typical bureau practice and contradicts Director Wray's testimony to Congress and his assurances. Wray laid out his approach at a recent national security conference.
You know, I'm not going to make decisions based on yelling and screaming. I'm going to make decisions based on the process.
In a series of tweets, the president emphasized Strzok was a decision maker in the FBI's Russia and Clinton email cases. Just fired agent Strzok, formerly of the FBI, was in charge of the crooked Hillary Clinton sham investigation, he tweeted. It was a total fraud on the American public and should be properly redone. Though the attorney general recused himself from the Russia probe, a senior House Republican told Fox he can still take action.
Name an individual, perhaps a U.S. attorney or some, or even a retired U.S. attorney, to investigate this agency, to have full access, to have subpoena authority, and to get to the bottom and the top of all of this past misconduct.
All right, that was Catherine Herridge earlier this week. And, of course, the big news this week was that Peter Strzok has lost his job at the FBI. Very controversial. Shouldn't be, because most of us who were paying attention to this saw that Peter Strzok, regardless of what he says, had a very definite bias. He was the man charged with inspecting or investigating Hillary Clinton's email server and her emails. He was the man charged with investigating collusion with Russia, allegedly by President Trump. He was the man who privately with his lover said that we were going to stop him, meaning the president. We won't let that happen. There's an insurance policy. And so bottom line, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, because of the actions of James Comey, Peter Strzok, Andrew McCabe and others have taken such a hit in the trust of the American people. But they're not the only agency. We find the CIA, the NSA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, all of them have taken a hit in terms of their reputation and for good reasons. That's what we want to talk about today. Can that ever change? Can our faith in these agencies ever be restored? Because it really is crucial that America have a strong intelligence agency. I've asked Dr. Michael Ledeen to join us today. Michael has a long history and understanding and experience with the intelligence agencies. He's the Freedom Scholar at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He's an internationally renowned scholar on Iran, Iraq, terrorism, and international security. He has served as a consultant to the National Security Council, the State Department, and the Defense Department, and as a special advisor to the Secretary of State. We could go on and on. He's authored 35 books, including his latest, Field of Fight, How to Win the War Against Radical Islam and Its Allies. And that was co-authored, by the way, with Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. Michael, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
In my long introduction, the one thing I didn't say that I want to say is that in addition to all the other things that Peter Strzok was involved in, he was one of two agents that interviewed Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. And that's noteworthy because, Michael, you know that they have accused Michael Flynn, the charge is lying to the FBI, and that's what he pled guilty to. Do you have any insight into the status? He's yet to be sentenced, and it's been months and months and months and months. Do you have any insight into what the status of that is?
I don't. I read the papers like everybody else. And all I know is they keep postponing it, apparently at Mueller's request.
Okay.
And what we know is that the judge, the sentencing judge, who's Judge Sullivan, is very critical of attorneys who press forward for convictions and guilty pleas and so forth. And he has asked for all the information that the prosecutors may have. That's Mueller. That would exonerate Flynn. So who knows what that is?
Yeah. You know, and maybe you can't answer this either, Michael, but people ask me all the time, because I've talked about it a lot on the air and defended General Flynn. People, and I think people are certainly inclined to believe that he's an innocent man based now on all that's developed this last 18 months. Do you have any insight into why he pleaded guilty? For heaven's sake, he was talking with Peter Strzok. We understand the circumstances now. He was caught off guard for that interview. He didn't have an attorney present, right, as I understand. And one of the FBI agents said that he did not lie. In fact, Comey repeated that he did not lie. So
yeah,
how did
that
it come
was the official. That was the official FBI position for a while.
Do you have any idea why he did plead guilty?
Well, I think he pleaded guilty in order to stop the pain. He was in a situation where every morning when he and his wife came out of their home in Alexandria, Virginia, there was a crowd there screaming at him, yelling, traitor, liar, so forth. I mean, life like that is very difficult.
My understanding, too, someone had told me that, and you can say yes or no or plead the fifth, but that the financial situation was very difficult, and that his own children were pitching in. He's got a large family that love him, and that it was just taking its toll financially and every other way on the entire family. So anyway, we're all watching to see how that develops and praying that justice is done in General Flynn's case. But that's another thing. It's worth bringing up today because of what happened with Peter Strzok this week, as his attorney and others cry foul for him being fired from the FBI. It's worth remembering that he was key to what happened with General Flynn. Michael, because you've been working with the intelligence agencies for so long, I think the first thing I'd like to start with is kind of the middle thing, and that is how would you describe the intelligence agencies as they were operating under the leadership of Barack Obama?
Well, I think it's wrong to start there. I think you have to go all the way back to the beginning and realize that CIA has always been highly politicized and involved in policy contrary to its charter and contrary to the intent of the people who created it. When President Truman was considering whether or not to recognize Israel, that's 1948, I think. Maybe 45, but 48 was the formal decision. CIA created a clandestine organization, secretly created an organization to lobby against recognition of Israel, created that inside the United States. So CIA, which was created to be to operate overseas outside the United States and to stay out of policy decisions from the very beginning, from its first hours, was political. And it's only gotten worse over the years. That is the one thing at which CIA has really excelled. And so when we get to Obama, we've got an organization that's been doing politics for a very, very long time.
Did you not say in your article, by the way, we're going to be referencing Michael's recent article in PJ Media, How to Fix the Intelligence Community, and we'll put that on our Facebook page, but we are going to be talking about that. Did you not say, Michael, in your sort of history of these intelligence agencies, that the CIA was actually pretty friendly and soft on communism in its past?
Yes, very few people know this, but during the McCarthy period, leftists at the State Department were moved over to CIA to protect them against McCarthy. So, and it's a funny story because it's the two Dulles brothers. Alan Dulles was head of CIA and John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State.
Wow, I didn't know that. This is interesting. So the Dulles brothers, are you saying it was them? Are you saying that they were soft on communism? Are you inferring that? Or are you just saying that they were in charge of those
agencies? No, I'm just saying it's funny because the deal was struck between two brothers. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, all right. So the CIA, this surprises me. So they were soft on communism. Because surprises me because we know, Michael, that John Brennan, fast-forwarding a couple, several decades here, that John Brennan was—I don't know if he was a registered communist—but the CIA director under Barack Obama voted for the communist candidate in 1980 or 82 in the presidential election. He was not a young man, not that young, that he didn't understand what communism was. All of us understood that in the 80s. That's pretty radical to think that the director would have voted for a communist candidate. Don't you think?
I do. I think it's very peculiar. And I don't think that a person who had been an active communist, he voted for Gus Hall for president, should have been director of Central Intelligence.
You know what else surprised me, Michael? Do you remember, I covered this on the show, and I don't remember how widely reported it was, but John Brennan, there was a recording of John talking with potential CIA employees, laughing about his radical past. And telling them not to worry if they had sort of things like that in their past, it wasn't a problem anymore. Did you see that tape?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, just shocking. Okay, so you contrast that with the history of the FBI, and it was interesting the way you described them. You described them as a high-tech cops, but their history was not softness on communism. Can you explain that?
No, FBI was different. FBI does law enforcement, and the main mission of FBI is to identify criminals and bring them to trial. So it's a very different function. But over the years, FBI grew and became more politicized. It went through one period of intense politicization under Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover. And then that appeared to have been reversed. And when I was in government, we had a very high opinion of FBI and very high confidence in FBI, which you cannot possibly have today. It went bad, too. It's almost a rule of bureaucracy, any bureaucracy. Is good for a maximum of maybe 20 years. And after 20 years, you have to change them.
Mm-hmm. You know, Mike, I can't, I always, this is always part of the discussion for me. My husband served with the FBI for almost 30 years and of course loved it. And there were, I know firsthand, there were during his time there, just still some great agents, loved the country, patriots, you know. At the time of 9/11, you know, that was pretty apparent. And as I look back on the foundings of the FBI, was it not born out of, I don't know if it was communist agitators like in the 30s or 20s in the United States? Wasn't that the kind of the birth of the FBI?
No, I think the birth of FBI was that we needed a federal force to deal with criminal organizations, which more and more were national, and to deal effectively with them, you had to have a national, in essence, a national police force.
Okay, but I think in watching, actually, I do think, Michael, in reading the history of it, I do think that part of it was born out of the need to counter these subversives who had started making their presence known in the United States, and I think that's when J. Edgar Hoover was appointed. But that's my understanding. And you know the history too, but I certainly J. Edgar Hoover was very anti-communist.
Oh yes.
Yeah, and so in contrast to the CIA, which you just described, you said State Department officials who were kind of soft ended up at CIA. Well, how about State Department?
Well, State, it's funny because you go back to the 50s and, 50s and 60s, and what you find is State Department much tougher on communism than the intelligence community. If you think of the intelligence community as a kind of college campus, you know, CIA has a classic Ivy League campus out there in Langley, Virginia. And the State Department were people who had served overseas and had seen communism in action. And there were an awful lot of sort of Ivy League type intellectuals. A lot of good work been done on the link, for example, between Yale and CIA.
Michael, hold that thought for a second. Let's come back to that when we return. We have to take a bit of a break here. My guest is Dr. Michael Ledeen. Again, he's the author of, several books, but Field of Fight, How to Win the War Against Radical Islam and Its Allies, co-authored by Lieutenant General Flynn, is his most recent. We're going to talk about if it's possible to fix these agencies in a minute. Sandy Rios, in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
It's almost a badge of honor when the president sees fit to go after individual private citizens.
I think Mr. Trump is not sophisticated enough, unfortunately, to deal with these foreign leaders in a manner that is going to protect U.S. national security interests.
I don't think he's medically unfit to be president. I think he's morally unfit to be president.
There is a bit of autocrat envy in terms of the president's attitude towards the president of the Russian Federation.
He's taken a series of steps that had Vladimir Putin dictated them, he couldn't have mirrored more effectively. What his motivations are, I think, is a legitimate question.
Those, ladies and gentlemen, are the heads of the intelligence agencies under Barack Obama. In order, James Clapper, John Brennan, James Comey, Michael Hayden, and then Susan Rice. Certainly, all of them active in trying to convince the American public that Donald Trump and his campaign were colluding with Russia. That's the reason he was elected, and so he must be destroyed. That's the narrative that's been the case for the last 2 years since President Trump took office. My guest is Michael Ledeen, and Michael's an expert in the intelligence community, and we're talking about the history of it. Then we're going to move to what happened under the Obama intelligence era, and then we're going to talk about how in the world we might fix that. Michael, we were talking about the State Department when we took a break, and you said that, think of a college campus, CIA was kind of the intellectual branch of the intelligence agencies. That's what you are saying, right? Michael?
Yes.
Oh, the question is that you're saying that the State Department was kind of the intellectual branch of the intelligence agencies, right?
No, CIA. CIA was the intellectual branch. CIA analysts think of themselves the same way Ivy League, you know, top university professors think of themselves.
Okay. Well, then how does State Department work in there? How did they view themselves, and how did they used to be viewed?
Well, State Department in the 50s and 60s were a lot tougher on communism than CIA was. CIA took it easy on communism.
Interesting.
Look, if you go back to pre-CIA years, look at OSS, you find no end of leftists. You know, Herbert Marcuse, who's the guru of the new left in the 60s in this country, he was in the OSS. No end of people like that were.
You know, it's interesting you should say that because, Michael, this is a bit off track, but indulge me for a second. I had the privilege of getting to know a woman who served in the OSS who became a baroness in Spain. She was in her 90s when I got, you may even actually know about her. Aline Griffith was her American name. And she married a She count. That's what she's the Countess de Romanonov. That was her title. She has this incredible story. She was like a model taken off the streets, discovered by someone. She knew director Woolsey knew her. And so Eileen, she may even still be alive. If she is, she's close to 100. But Eileen was a fierce patriot, you know, and still is, still very, was keeping up with American politics. So I assumed that that was the way the old OSS was. I sort of had my evaluation through the eyes of the Countess de Romanones, but you say that's not the case?
Well, it wasn't the case for everyone. As I say, Marcuse was in there.
That's amazing.
You know, and we know all about him. So my guess is that OSS was heavily penetrated by the Soviets, and there were plenty of pro-Soviet people in there.
So that's the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA, just for people to know that.
Yeah, but a lot of OSS people rolled over into CIA.
Yeah, okay. All right, so that gives some great background. And so really, actually, what you're saying is that these agencies then under President Obama, we're going to fast forward several decades here, some of them were staying kind of true to their history and their form before.
Well, sure. There's a big literature now, substantial literature, on the extent to which people in CIA were very, very soft on radical Islam. And one of the reasons why Flynn was targeted by CIA and much of the rest of the intelligence community was that he was not. And he knew the extent to which we talk about collusion a lot, but the extent to which CIA analysts were soft on radical Islam and did not think it was a threat.
Is it true that during the Obama years, there was sort of a purge, however great or small, among these agencies to make sure that the conservative hangovers were sort of purged? Did that happen? Or are there still some that managed to live through that?
Well, mostly they, people in agencies like that, career professionals, they just accommodate to the views of the administration. So when you get an Obama who is opposed to a campaign against radical Islam, what you find is that advocates from consultants, advisors, scholars, who have been used to educate intelligence professionals, FBI people, local police, and so forth, they just get locked out. And the agencies are told not to use language like radical Islam or Islamists or jihadis and so forth. And the whole thing gets tamped down.
You know, it still is. That's amazing. Some of those policies are still holding over. I think that news story recently about that encampment in South and New Mexico,
where they were
and the FBI, according to what I read, is still using the same policies, you know, to handle with kid gloves any report of Muslim terrorism. You know, it's the domestic terrorism that they were taught under James Comey and Bob Mueller. It was domestic terror that was the center of their focus, not Islamic terror, and that's why every terrorist attack that has happened in the country in the last several years, they always rush to say, oh, we're not sure it's terrorism. Oh, don't jump to that conclusion. And then they don't. It's just, I think people are beginning to see that. But I was shocked to see that same policy in place. Were you?
No, I wasn't. I mean, that's what I thought was going on. And if you go into the news stories on how many terrorists have been arrested in this country, how many plots have been foiled in the last 10 years, 15 years. It's astonishing. There's hundreds and hundreds of them. And we have caught organizations like Hezbollah, which is Iran, smuggling terrorists across the southern border into the United States. There's lots of them here.
So, Michael, as you look at this, and we sort of at least touched on, and people are already kind of inherently aware that there was something wrong with the intelligence agencies during the Obama administration. Is there really, really any way to fix this?
Well, Senator Moynihan years ago said, you can't fix this. You cannot change its culture. And so you can't reform CIA, FBI, DIA, you name it. You have to shut it down, and you have to start all over again. You need new people. You need a new generation, and you have to start all over again from scratch. This can be done. It's not easy, but you can do it.
Do you think that the president, is there anybody in his circles now that would be inclined? Well, let's talk about who he's got in place. I was just kind of making a little note myself. He's got Dan Coats at Defense Intelligence, Chris Wray at FBI, John Bolton, National Security Advisor now, and Mike Pompeo, CIA. Let me ask you first, how do you think they're doing?
Some areas they do pretty well. I mean, our technological intelligence is superb. Our satellites, our drones, our observers, and so on. It's generally agreed that our human intelligence is not very good, and that we're not all that good at recruiting, say, Muslim terrorists, jihadis, and so forth. And we were never all that good at recruiting communists. Contrary to popular belief, almost every major communist agent that worked for CIA during the Cold War was a walk-in. They came to us. We didn't identify and recruit them.
Hmm. How
and
interesting.
There are cases, one of which I mentioned in the PJ Media story, was General Pacepa from Romania, who was the head of the Romanian Secret Intelligence Service. He drove to Germany one day and walked into our embassy in Bonn and defected to the United States. He's now under witness protection program. He is still under death sentence from Romania.
Wow.
But we were very upset with him at the beginning, CIA was, because CIA held the position that Ceausescu was truly independent of the Soviet Union. And Pacepa came over and said, no, everything that Ceausescu does is dictated to him by the KGB. And CIA was so upset with that that they said, either you change your testimony or we're going to send you back to Romania, which was a death sentence from the United States. So Pacepa happily survived.
You know, I have to say, just for the sake of history, just so people know, because these names people don't recognize, you know, Michael, you have a lot of knowledge and people are younger or they just aren't even educated the way they should be. But Ceausescu was... just for their purposes, he was the president of Romania, and he was probably the most brutal of the Soviet bloc dictators or mini dictators. Would you agree with that?
Well, he was a terrible man, and his wife was a terrible woman. Pacepa, by the way, people interested in communism and the history of communism should read Pacepa's book, Red Horizons. It's the single best book I've ever read on the nature of a communist state.
Wow, I'd love to read that, and that's a great tip. And by the way, let me just also say, Michael's article about what we're talking about, how to fix the intelligence community, that's the name of it, is on PJ Media, and we're going to put this on our Facebook page so that you can read it. So, Michael, your premise is that the only way to really fix this, but you believe it's possible, is to shut down these agencies and start from scratch, pretty much.
Right, right.
And who would do that? If you whispered in John Bolton's ear or Mike Pompeo's, you think they would do a thing like that?
Well, Pompeo was head of CIA for a while, and so far as I know, he did not make major changes. I think the way the intelligence community structured itself these days is that a director only gets a tiny handful of political appointments. So, by and large, if you get to be head of CIA, you go in and you work with the people you find there. Pompeo seems to be doing the same sort of thing at the State Department as Secretary of State. So it's good bureaucratic practice, but I'm not sure it's what we need right now.
You know who, of this lineup, me thinks that John Bolton would be the closest person to being a cheerleader for this because he was, as Secretary of State, he was so hated there because, sort of like Michael Flynn was hated at DIA. I think he would have the courage to do this. It's a suggestion. Certainly, wouldn't it be good, Michael, if we could do this in all the agencies, either the Department of Education or college and university system? That's what we need. We need a restart. We need the restart button that Hillary used. Maybe it's on sale somewhere. But
Jefferson said you got to change government periodically because otherwise it gets corrupted.
Excellent, and great way to end. The article is How to Fix the Intelligence Community. My guest was Dr. Michael Ledeen. Thank you so much for listening. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.